Monday, February 28th. Thank you for all coming, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 502. I'd like to make some opening remarks, if you don't mind. You know, Oregonians, when I was campaigning, going door to door, Oregonians, one of the most important things they were telling me at the door was the state legislature has to deal with the high rising cost of health care. And hospitals are the single highest cost driver in the system, and that's why 502 is in front of us. And I think it offers us the opportunity to discuss this, and it would this bill would definitely transform an industry that charges the uninsured more than it charges a health care insurance company into an industry that really would charge everyone the same. It also would transform an industry whose providers have the power to demand the patients pay whatever they are charged into an industry where hospital costs are open to public scrutiny and where hospitals would be paid only for the costs that an efficiently run hospital would incur. And finally, the bill does create the opportunity for sharing the costs for indigent and uncompensated care. I'm excited to really start this discussion. I know there's a lot of consternation, a lot of heartache and grief from people, but there's a lot of excitement, too. Hospitals are an essential component of our healthcare system. And what we really want to try to do here is make it more accessible and more affordable for Oregonians. With that, I think I would like to call Lynn Marie Kreider and Joe DeNicola? DeNicola to the fan. Okay. If you could just walk through. Do you want to walk us through the bill, or should we have them walk?
Senator, I would probably defer to our presenters to talk, to kind of walk the bill section by section, when appropriate.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Marie Kreider, healthcare policy advocate for SEIU Local 49, and with me is Joe DeNicola, president of SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. And our thought was to have Joe give you a bit of comment, and then that I would walk you through the bill, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee tonight. I'm Joe DeNicola, as Lynn Marie mentioned, president of SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. In order to serve as president of our 35,000 members of our statewide union, I took a leave of absence from my position as a corporate tax auditor at the Oregon Department of Revenue. We're both here, Lynn Marie and I, to speak tonight in support of Senate Bill 502. Now, we're not here today to tell you more about the rising prices we all pay for hospital services. And we know, I think we all know, that the problem is reaching crisis proportions. Instead, we're here today to remind you that Oregon and its citizens are not helpless in the face of this crisis. We can change this cost picture if we're willing to do some things and try some things that haven't been tried in the past. Now, SB 502 will create the statutory authority needed to employ a powerful regulatory tool that will reduce spending for hospital services. At the same time, this bill will create incentives for good outcomes and incentives for good practices and for efficiency in the delivery of hospital services. Now, there are some who are going to say that it's enough for this legislature to shine a light on hospital pricing and require some form of disclosure. Then they're going to tell you that prices will go down due to market pressures. I don't believe we can or should rely solely on market pressures to solve this problem, and here's why. Last week, Oregonians for Health Security issued a report And in that report, they demonstrated that there is no competitive market for hospital services in this state. It's true that one of the reasons hospitals are not competitive is that consumers and market and payers don't have information about price and quality. And aggressive transparency requirements could go a long way toward alleviating that part of the problem. But unfortunately, the most significant reason that the market is not competitive in most communities is that there's only one hospital. Even in the Tri-County area, the market is dominated by just two large healthcare systems. And in that environment, using information and transparency by itself is highly unlikely to produce any real competition. So in this non-competitive environment, the state has the absolute responsibility and authority to step in and correct the excessive power of hospitals to set those prices unilaterally. Their potential for price gouging is placing every Oregonian's access to quality, affordable health care at risk. And the citizens and taxpayers of this state can no longer be asked to foot the bill for these powerful interest groups. Now, Oregon citizens can and do balance their tight budgets by careful choices in the marketplace, whether they're buying an automobile, a car, a pair of new shoes, or a home. But it's irresponsible to tell our citizens that they must pay unreasonable fees for hospital services or choose to forgo necessary medical care if the money is tight. If we don't step in, hospitals will continue to operate inefficiently, and where they can, they'll continue to rack up profits far above the national average. They'll continue to be certain that consumers must cover whatever costs they choose to incur to operate, to expand, and even to pad the bottom line. Now, just last year, the Public Employee Benefits Board in the Regents Plan saw a 28% increase in per-member spending for hospital care. That's a 28% increase per member. Some of that spending does reflect increased utilization, but we're told that much of that increase does not reflect increased utilization. Oregon cannot afford to allow the hospital industry to operate without accountability to healthcare consumers any longer. Employers, health plan participants, businesses, and taxpayers throughout our state are unable to sustain a health industry that's behaving more like a monopoly than a free market. So on behalf of the 35,000 employees of SEIU Local 503 OPEU, I urge you to take the first step and enact Senate Bill 502 and take that first step to bring accountability to this industry. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Lynn Marie Kreider of SEIU Local 49, and I want to support the bill, and I will walk you through it and also suggest a couple of minor changes, if I may. This bill creates the legal authority to go with the moral authority and responsibility that the legislature has to regulate healthcare facilities, which includes hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers. So it would be to regulate the rates that they charge to payers other than Medicare and Medicaid programs. The bill describes the purpose of the program as, quote, to achieve access, accountability, predictability, and stability of healthcare facilities and reasonable rates for the public, unquote. The bill sets these general policies for the regulatory program and then leaves it up to the regulator to create the kind of program that works for Oregon hospitals and consumers. First, rates must be reasonably relate to the cost of providing the service in the aggregate. And put another way, rates must reflect the total costs of operating the healthcare facility and a reasonable rate of profit, but cross-subsidization is appropriate. We heard earlier our experts from the state of Maryland talked about trying to set some some macro controls while allowing hospitals to do some work internally on their own rather than micromanaging every detail. I think this bill does that. Second, the bill says that it is the policy of the program that underlying costs reflected in the rates must be reasonable. So rates may not allow a facility to pass on costs that should not have been incurred. Third, rates must be set equitably among payers. This addresses the relationship between what is charged to various purchasers. Although it does not require the regulator to set identical rates for each class of payers, it would suggest that the huge spread between what facilities now charge to the uninsured and to the insured should be eliminated. And that those general policies are at page 2, lines 39 to 44 of the bill. The Medicare program already sets fees for the Medicare program after analyzing the cost of operating an efficient hospital. Medicaid sets rates, reimbursement rates. Enactment of this bill would extend a rate-setting mechanism that would protect uninsured patients and commercial payers, including public bodies that provide health insurance for their employees. Now, I'll go through the bill sections by section. Sections 1 and 2 create the Health Services Cost Review Board in the Department of Human Services. That board is an independent body. Its members are appointed by the governor to terms set by statute. Section 3, paragraph 1, directs the board.
Lynn-Marie.
Yes.
In subset 3, it's, or, yeah, 3, the board shall have a majority of members who are not involved in the operation or management of a health care facility and who don't have a pecuniary interest or direct financial interest in a healthcare facility. Can you explain why you don't actually have healthcare facility people involved in a rate setting?
Well, Section 1, Sub 2 calls on the governor to appoint members of the board that represent the diversity of healthcare facilities. So you would have some representation of regulated healthcare facilities. Then you would also have other sorts of providers, insurers, healthcare purchasers, and employees and consumers. So that you would have, what I think the bill says is you wouldn't have a majority of that board that would be regulated and representing regulated entities, but rather you would have a minority participation on the board of regulated entities.
Okay.
Section 3, paragraph 1 directs the board to set rates for each healthcare facility, establishing what the facility may charge for hospital services and to provide for annual adjustment of those rates. Note that a healthcare facility is defined later on, page 4, lines 41 to 43, to include both hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers. The terms hospital rate and hospital services aren't defined. So what the board is given the authority to regulate hospital rates that may be charged to by healthcare facilities. It's my understanding that the bill is intended to regulate rates charged by surgery centers, ambulatory care surgery centers, for services that would otherwise be provided in a hospital. It may be that that is not as clear as it should be, so I would flag that as something that the committee should consider and perhaps clarify.
Where along that, Ms. Crider?
Section 3, paragraph 1 says, first sentence there, the Healthcare Services Cost Review Board shall regulate hospital rates.
You're going too fast.
Sorry.
Okay.
All right. So page 2, line 11, section 3.1 says the Health Services Cost Review Board shall regulate hospital rates charged by healthcare facilities. Then later on in the bill, at page 4, lines 41 to 44, you have the definition of healthcare facility. And that definition includes ambulatory care surges centers as well as hospitals. And I'm simply saying that the lack of definition of hospital rates leads to some ambiguity, perhaps. Council thought it was clear, but I think it perhaps hasn't been to all readers. So I just flag that issue.
So you're saying the intent of the bill is to cover the ambulatory surgical.
Correct, treatment. Because there are overlapping market niche, in a sense, the same kind of services provided in two separate kinds of facilities.
Senator
Marquette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go back to lines 7, 8, 9 on the first page? And I'm sorry I didn't do that sooner. I asked this morning if the consumer advocate was on the board in Maryland. They said no. This is very vague. I mean, I can't you tighten up a little bit the people? I'm assuming that you had something to do with the drafting of this bill. Is that correct?
I did have something to do with the drafting of the bill. I think this is common drafting that doesn't actually create representatives of particular entities, but gives direction to the governor about the kinds of interests that want to be represented. And it does include consumers, unlike Maryland.
It's too vague, but I'll let it go at that.
Okay.
I think we ought to have consumer advocate. I mean, okay.
That would certainly not be a problem from our standpoint. Section 3, paragraphs 2, 3, and 4 are sort of the meat of the bill. They empower the board to utilize information submitted to the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research, as well as to require filing of additional information by healthcare facilities that's necessary in order to set rates. It also empowers the board to establish the rate-setting methodology. In other words, the formulas are not in the bill, but rather the board is given the authority to establish general rules for how we're going to set rates. The board is encouraged in the bill to set incentive rates that would encourage adequate staffing levels and provision of charity care. I would note here that I believe that the board could establish, under the bill as written, could establish incentive rates to award good health care outcomes or efficient operations or good practice generally. It may be, however, that the committee would want to make that very explicit, that there is a general authority to use incentive rates as part of the system in order to encourage what we consider to be good practice. Section 3, paragraph 5, at page 2, lines 39
to 40. Ms. Kreider,
yes.
It'd help if you just gave us the line number because it's
oh, and not hard. The paragraph numbers, okay.
Yeah.
So page 2, lines 39 to 44, lists the guiding principles for the rate-setting program that I discussed at the outset of the testimony. That is, that they must reflect the actual costs, reasonable costs, and be fair as between payers. Balance of Section 3 authorizes the board to hire staff, to make rules, to assess fees to support the program. So the program would not be funded by general fund, but rather by fees established by the board. In the state of Maryland, there is a fee per inpatient discharge that funds the program. This doesn't lock us into that particular kind of fee, but authorizes the board to charge fees to operate the program. On page 3, starting at line 6, there is the requirement that hospitals charge the rates established by the board. So the rates are not a ceiling, but rather the rates are the rates, and the rates set by the board must be charged by hospitals. A facility may, however, request review and modification of established rate. And that provides a remedy for a facility that believes that the annual adjustment formula used by the board is not appropriate to that facility's particular circumstance. Section 5 at page 3, line 13, authorizes the board to levy civil penalties. Section 6 at page 3, line 24, requires the Office of Health Policy and Research to require hospitals and surgery centers to file annually whatever patient discharge information is required by the board. And a later section allows the office to prescribe the form of reporting. The next section, Section 7, is just definitional.
Thank you, Chair. Lynn, the extra duties or additional duties or provisions of the bill for Oregon Health Policy Research Office, what do you anticipate? How extensive would they be? Are these things you're doing already? Would it require considerable, say, resource or capacity of the OHPR to conduct those activities?
I think they're minimal. They're mainly passing through in additional information that's required of the by the board. There also is something that asks them to do reports on hospital rates, costs, and charges, and that's, you see that at page 5, line 19. So I suppose that would that could conceivably take some additional, but it's really within the broad mandate that I think they already have. So I would not see this being an additional burden on that office. So Section 9, what we've just discussed, expands slightly what the Office of Health Policy and Research is required to study. Section 10, and that's page 5, starting at line 35, adds some additional things that OOPR should collect. Information concerning staffing levels and the amount of charity care. Now, they already collect data on the amount of charity care, so this is simply putting in the statute something that they already do. Section 11, which is at page 6, line 28, is the statute that deals with licensure of hospitals and revocation of licensure, and it simply adds an additional ground that if you systematically, if I remember the term, violate the rules in this statute, a substantial failure to comply with this statute as well as many others is a ground for revocation of a license. On page 7, starting at line 6, is the language that states the applicability of the rate-making authority. So it says at line 6, except as provided in the rules adopted by the board, the Act does not apply to rates a healthcare facility may charge to federal health care payers. So it wouldn't apply to the Medicare program in the absence of a waiver. And I take it would not, although this may be somewhat less clear, would not apply to the Medicaid program without a waiver. Subsection 2 of that section at page 7, line 9, directs the Department of Human Services to seek a waiver to exempt Oregon from the payment rules in the Medicare and Medicaid programs so that there could be an all-payer system here. I'll come back to that in a minute. The bill would become operative on July 1, 06. That is Section 4. So the duty to charge only the regulated rate comes into effect July 1 of 2006. The bill itself has an emergency clause so that the agency, there would be about a year for the agency to get ready to establish rates. Let me say at this point that I would recommend that Section 12 of the bill, which requires DHS to request a waiver, be amended to permit the department to seek a waiver perhaps with the approval of the emergency board. And I make that recommendation somewhat reluctantly, because I think a very good case has been made today for why an all-payer system where the Medicare and Medicaid programs pay under the same system as commercial payers and uninsured individuals makes sense. But in the short term, to do that would probably require Oregon to spend more money to reimburse hospitals than we've done for the last year, or is budgeted this year in the governor's budget. So it seems to me that it may be wiser to have some discretion to move on to requesting that waiver when we have the money to invest in that. It's a good investment. If we increase hospital rates in the Medicaid program, it reduces cost shift and I think ultimately makes for a stronger program. But if we don't have the money in the short term, I think we can go forward, and it makes sense to go forward. There are some who will argue that if this bill does not require the Oregon Health Plan to pay the same rate as commercial payers, that there's no reason to enact the bill at all. They are right only if the sole problem that we have in Oregon with regard to spending for hospital services is the cost shift caused by under-reimbursement by government payers. And I would suggest that it's not the only problem. Cost shift doesn't account for the high administrative costs that some hospitals pass on to payers. It doesn't account for the fact that some hospitals charge more because they don't operate as efficiently as other hospitals. Cost shift doesn't account for the high profit margins that some of the state's large urban hospitals extract from payers. And cost shift doesn't account for the fact that hospitals actually charge us for the cost of fixing the problems that they make. If a hospital makes a mistake and they have to do more procedures, we pay for it. That's not something that's caused by cost shift. So I just want to suggest to you that this bill has the potential to make some important changes in our system, whether or not we are able to get a waiver that creates the same kind of all-payer system that Maryland has. I have attached to my testimony a one-page summary of the several points that I made where I thought perhaps the committee should consider an amendment.
I have your testimony.
You don't? Well, that's because I didn't give it to you. I'm sorry.
Here I've been writing all this stuff down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have. Just following along.
I might never have given it to you. Page 6 of the testimony is a list of the 4 points that that I made with respect to possible amendments. And then the last page, I have attached an effort to suggest the magnitude of potential savings of a rate regulation process. And I know that's a daring thing to do because we don't know what the methodology will be. But I think what it shows to you is even if we just shaved a bit off the trend, the upward trend in hospital costs, we would be saving $100 million a year, and it could be much bigger than that. And I think for Oregonians, that's very significant. For the cost that this legislature budgets for employee health care, state employee health care, and the costs that the state subsidizes in terms of health care for public school employees as well, that we're talking about major potential savings over time to the general fund. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify, and we'd be happy to answer any further questions that you may have.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Mary Beth Healy from the Oregonians for Health Security.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Bear with me just one moment. My name is Maribeth Healy, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening in support of Senate Bill 502. So as you know, Oregonians for Health Security is a coalitional organization of concerned individuals, consumer groups, business leaders, and healthcare professionals concerned about the escalating cost of healthcare. And we've been uniting to work on issues that address the cost drivers in healthcare and to reduce the cost of healthcare and expand access to Oregonians. And we have found, of course, no surprise to any of you, that from small businesses to healthcare workers, everyone is concerned about not only their own healthcare, but those of their friends and their neighbors. And so in examining why healthcare costs are increasing at such crippling rates, we learn that to reduce costs, we must address the top cost drivers, pharmaceutical, hospital, and insurance costs. And last session, we worked on the prescription drug purchasing pool because prescription drugs at that juncture were the fastest growing and the leading cost driver within overall healthcare costs. This session, we want to expand the prescription drug pool so that more folks can save, obviously. And require some increasing accountability and better audit functions by the state for insurance industry and to ensure fair hospital pricing, which is what I'm here to speak to today. So last week, as has been referenced, it released a report that documents how large hospital systems are a leading force driving up the cost of Oregonians' health care. And these hospital companies contribute to the fact that Oregon is the fifth most expensive place to spend the night in the hospital in the whole country, and our costs seem to be rising higher than the national average. And I have some charts that I'll attach to my testimony when I do pass that out. and that 36% of, excuse me, third, well, it is the same, I guess, but 36 cents of every health care dollar pays for hospital care, and that's more than any other health care expenditure, which I think is important as we look at what is increasing costs for our state and for health care consumers. And as health care consumers, we don't exactly know what we're paying for and how much we can expect to pay for any given service. And I think that's an important thing to look at, too, as we look at opening up the opportunity for the legislature to look at rate review in Senate Bill 502. And so we must put patients first and demand fair pricing for hospital services and other health care services. So, and Senate Bill 502 sets out to do exactly that, to ensure fair pricing for hospital services. In Oregon, large hospital companies have higher list prices than small independent hospitals. For treatment of the most common patient conditions, such as delivering a baby, sometimes as much as 39% more than an independent hospital for the same procedure at the same time. And for patients who have little choice in where to go for their hospitalization, this is unfair pricing. And so currently, as we've heard, uninsured Oregonians and uninsured Americans actually pay the highest price for their hospital services. And it's an unfair pricing scheme that leaves many families, as we heard 2 weeks ago, financially strapped and devastated by an illness or an accident that could happen to any of us. And as you've heard before, a recent Harvard University study found that 50% of bankruptcies, personal bankruptcies, are because of unpaid medical bills. And there's got to be something better we can do around that to protect Oregonians. And so Senate Bill 502 will bring fairness and balance to Oregon's hospital system and pricing. It will ensure that whether you're in a hospital here in Salem or Baker City, Portland, or Astoria, excuse me, that you pay a fair price for your procedure. And ultimately, we believe that Senate Bill 502 will reduce the cost of hospital services and, in turn, health care in general. And this looks like a common-sense solution to what is clearly a health care crisis in our state.
Thank you. Any questions? Discussion? Thank you.
Steve Dixon from Osberg.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 502. For the record, my name is Steve Dixon. I'm the consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a statewide nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest and advocacy organization with over 28,000 members throughout the state of Oregon. I don't really want to belabor the points that have been made by the previous speakers. I think that our position is pretty much in line with theirs. However, I do want to emphasize the consumer stakes a little bit. This bill is crucial in controlling healthcare costs and creating a marketplace that is actually functional and fair. Right now, I don't think that you can really defend the marketplace in by saying it's functional and fair or transparent. It's a marketplace with little competition, and any competition in the marketplace is diluted by the lack of information provided to consumers, and also diluted by the lack of choice that many Oregonians face when they're actually going for inpatient and outpatient services. Patients can't choose hospitals based on price and quality. And in a lot of Oregon, there is only one hospital in the area. In Metro Portland, my understanding is that most of the inpatient and outpatient marketplace is controlled primarily by two providers, but there is a little more competition. But lack of info and lack of competition are the two main justifications for doing rate regulations in other marketplaces, and I would point to utilities, public utilities, as sort of a parallel. So with Senate Bill 502 is really about fairness and transparency, and we're happy to be here in support of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dixon. Questions? Thank you.
Okay.
Martin Taylor, Oregon Nurses Association.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor with the Oregon Nurses Association, and we don't have written testimony today, so you're not missing anything. I don't have it. I will actually be quite brief. I wanted to give you just an overview of how the Oregon Nurses Association came to the conclusion that we needed to make Senate Bill 502 one of our priorities in this legislative session. When we did a retreat with our members and listed many different issues that they could be working on, from trying to reduce the cost of malpractice insurance, reducing back injuries, biodiesel, certificate of need, school-based health, a long list of things, this was one of the issues that bubbled up because it hit a particular chord with our members, and that chord was it is difficult for a nurse to see a patient charge a different rate than another patient and to know that the patient who is being charged more is being charged more because they're uninsured. It essentially means that you're shifting costs on the people least able to pay, and that's a very difficult situation. Now, to give you some sense, this bill was a little bit of a debate within our association because there are hospitals who are, in fact, facing a crisis, and there are hospitals that are reacting to the loss of Oregon Health Plan, the high rate of the uninsured, the fact that many hospitals now have to deal with mentally ill patients that were otherwise covered before. We have a great deal of sympathy for that situation, and our concern was that if we came and talked about the high costs of hospitals, people might have the misperception that hospitals were just doing super well in the state. The fact is both things are true. You have some hospitals that are doing very well, and you have some hospitals that are doing very poorly, and our folks felt like we couldn't avoid this conversation about fairness simply because, at the same time, some hospitals really need your assistance right now. We need to be making both those cases to you. And there was a little bit of pushback within our association because some folks said, hey, when hospitals do well, nursing contracts do well. Isn't this sort of adverse to our own economic interest? I would say this is the most important point that nurses are bringing to you. This is fundamentally an issue for us of rate fairness. You can call it rate reform, but it's rate fairness. You have individual patients who suffer when the system is this out of balance and there's this much cost shift. So whatever your final solutions to this bill are, we hope you carry away a desire to create fairness in the rates between different so that people are charged the same price for the same services, you create transparency in the system so people have some ability to buy, and that we come out of this with some effort to do cost control. And I think that how the exact mechanism that you do cost control, that we've got creative minds in this process on both sides, but that the question should be brought forward to the industry, how would you accept this challenge to try to find fairness in the system and to control some of the costs in the system? I think that this is a solution that we can support, and we'll support 502 as it's written, but we certainly believe that it is appropriate for other ideas to come forward as well, and that the industry should take on that challenge. And that's our testimony, unless you have questions.
Question? Thank you. Thanks. Tim Nesbitt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon, and speaking on behalf of the 180,000 union members in this state who bargain health care and care about health care and rate it continually number one on their list of concerns. If I can briefly state some of the context for my testimony, it's simply that we can't go on like this. We can't continue to absorb health care cost increases of 9% to 12% per year and still preserve our standard of living. Every working family is being squeezed by rising health care costs. Every time our unions go to the bargaining table, we face the problem of how even our best employers, those most committed to maintaining health benefits for their workers, can continue to afford the unaffordable. And every year, more and more of our members face that trade-off between even a modest gain in take-home pay and the need to meet the costs of health care. We think Senate Bill 502 goes to the heart of this problem by targeting the largest and fastest growing component of health care costs. As this report by Oregonians for Health Security, which I'm sure you have a copy of, documents in persuasive detail, we don't have a competitive market for hospital care, much less an efficient one. And without a transparent system of pricing, we can never get to an efficient market. And as long as we're isolated and segregated as consumers, even in fair-sized employer plans, will never be able to affect price in this marketplace. So given the concentration of ownership in the hospital sector and the do-or-die importance of the services they provide, we need a system of the kind proposed in Senate Bill 502 to ensure a fair and efficient market for these services and fair prices for them as well. And in past sessions, we brought to you proposals to mandate more of a commitment by employers to provide health care for their workers, to expand coverage for children, or expand the number of working people who are covered by the Medicaid plan in this state. But we're convinced now that cost is at the heart of the problem and that we must get cost under control if we can ever expect to expand access for working middle-class families as well as the working poor. Senate Bill 502 is right on target for getting costs under control and the best way to help open the door to expanded access as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nesbitt. Questions? Ellen Penny.
For the record, my name is Ellen Penny. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign. We are strongly supportive of Senate Bill 502. It's no coincidence that health care costs and the uninsurance rate in Oregon are growing simultaneously. As the annual increases in health care costs continue to exceed annual increases in per capita income, so too will the ability of Oregonians and or their employers to afford necessary and cost-effective health care become more elusive. Real cost containment is essential to any effort to address the health care crisis. Real cost containment is not reducing benefits and increasing out-of-pocket costs for increasingly inadequate insurance plans. It deals with costs. When employers and individuals are asked to pay for the drugs, hospitals, and provider services they need to prevent illness, improve health, and deal with medical and mental health emergencies. Beyond reducing the rapidly escalating increases in costs of hospital services, Senate Bill 502 should be expected to drastically reduce administrative overhead and improve equity in the system. I heard the insightful testimonies provided by Mr. Murray and Colmers from Maryland, As you know, Maryland has in place a hospital rate setting system very similar to the one envisioned by Senate Bill 502. And we would ask that this legislature embrace the founding goals of Maryland's 1971 law as presented in the testimony you heard earlier. And I think that those principles and foundations deserve repeating. They were to control hospital costs, to improve access to care, to make an equitable system, to ensure financial stability and predictability for hospitals and patients, and to reduce cost shift. Senate Bill 502 will do the same. Maryland experience clearly indicates that if Senate Bill 502 is enacted, Oregon will be able to get a handle on hospital cost increases. Equity and administrative efficiency are equally important. By spreading the cost of charity care across hospitals, 502 would create equity in a system in which some hospitals provide the lion's share of charity care in Oregon today and others very little. It would create equity in a system in which type of coverage or lack thereof determines how much will be paid by different payers for the exact same services. And one must believe, to some extent or another, length of stay for some of those patients. And clearly, by eliminating the need for different payers to negotiate with and then compensate each hospital based on wildly differing reduction-off-bill charge formulas, Senate Bill 502 would be expected to reduce administrative costs. I did provide for you a bill from a personal friend of mine, which is what we believe to be billed charge, and I think it's worth just thinking about what a system as is envisioned by Senate Bill 502 would create for a bill like this. In other words, currently people who are paying the bill charges, as you know, are self-pay patients, and off of those bill charges, depending on what insurer is paying the bill, would come various discounts. It creates enormous inequity and enormous inefficiency in the system. So thank you for your time, and thank you for having the hearing this evening.
Thank you. The last person on the list is Ken Rutledge. And Ken.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Rutledge, president of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'll probably have a little different perspective than the earlier witnesses. First of all, I have nothing but good things to say about the Maryland system. And in fact, if there was some way we could turn back time and have that kind of system here in Oregon, I think given the struggles we're dealing with now with large numbers of uninsured and rising charity care and bad debts, it would probably be a pretty good system. But the fact of the matter is that we can't have the Maryland system. If we take a look at what was said earlier today, in fact, we're not going to see the federal government step forward and say we're going to raise your payment rates to the same level as whatever your rate-setting commission sets them at. Secondly, our own Medicaid program would not be able to afford to even increase the amount of payment to get up to the level of hospital costs, much less any margin, much less their pro rata share of charity care or bad debts, as is in the case in Maryland. We talked a lot about cost and efficiency, and some of the materials that I provided for members of the committee include some comparisons. I mean, we've heard a lot about costs, and I think one of the things that you need to be aware of is that if we look at costs expressed as hospital expenditures spread across our population, in other words, hospital expenditures per capita, in fact, even after 30 years of rate setting in Maryland, Oregon continues to have lower per capita hospital expenditures than does Maryland. And in fact, if you take a look at the difference in our rates, our per capita spending on hospitals, my recollection when I did the math was that if we actually had the Maryland level of per capita spending, it would be costing us an additional roughly $225 million a year in spending. So when we talk about efficiency, Oregon has one of the has the second shortest hospital length of stay in the country. We have one of the lower admission rates in the country. We put fewer people in the hospital. We keep them a shorter period of time. And as a result, we spend less on hospital care in Oregon than most other states, including Maryland. You're already aware that there have been seven states that have had mandatory rate-setting commissions historically, not only the ones that were mentioned earlier today in New Jersey, New York, and Massachusetts, but also Wisconsin, our neighbor to the north, Washington, Michigan. All in all, there have been seven states that have decided that the rate setting didn't work. We have two left. We have Maryland with its all-payer system, and we have West Virginia, which established rate setting in 1983. Some of the charts, once again, that I have shown you indicate that if you look at hospital spending in West Virginia, it's not only higher than it is here in Oregon, it's higher than the national average. They have a rate-setting system, but they don't have an all-payer system. They've attempted to get a waiver. They haven't been successful. And so what they have there is a system that has all of the regulatory controls, but none of the benefits of what they have in Maryland, which is to spread those costs out over all of the payers. And if we established rate setting here, what we would end up with is, in effect, a commission that only regulates that roughly 41% of our patients who are covered by private insurance. In West Virginia, it's even worse. The public employees are not covered by the rate setting commission's rates either. So if we're looking really at efficiency, I think we've done a pretty good job here. Without rate setting, we have less spending here per capita. And even if you take, and you notice in the materials that I provided with you on the narrative and comparing us with Maryland, you'll notice that even on patient revenues on a per capita basis, that we're also on a par with the state of Maryland. As to the issue of transparency and the collection of data, I saw the list of information that's available in Maryland as a result of their commission. And if you take a look at what's available here, there's really not a whole lot of difference. For many years, we've had a requirement that hospitals, this actually, I've been with the association since 1988, and this was legislation that was passed before then, sometime in the mid-80s. We require audited hospital financial statements to be filed with the state on an annual basis. We require Medicare cost reports to be filed with the state on an annual basis. We have monthly utilization and financial data that is mandated that hospitals report to the state on a quarterly basis, but it's monthly data. That includes financial data, charity care data, utilization data, payer mix data. In addition, just like Maryland, every single hospital admission and now every outpatient surgical case is reported in terms of the diagnosis, the cost, the charges, all of that information, the same, basically the same database that they have in Maryland, and all of that information is available with about a three-month delay after the actual date. So if we're looking at the information that needs to be collected to provide for the transparency, it exists, and there's 10 to 15 years worth of that data that is available. So I think that you don't need this kind of a legislative approach if what we're really trying to do is get at information. The information's there. I think decisions have to be made about how it's going to present it, and I think it's one of the things that the state is working on with a number of task forces determining what's the appropriate information and how do you provide it. If we look at the cost drivers, we're not unlike any other state. Supplies, the cost of the things that we use in providing care, that includes pharmaceuticals, that includes the implants that are used in surgical procedures, that's part of what drives the cost. Utilities, malpractice insurance rates, it's the same thing really that you're going to see in just about any other part of the country, with maybe the exception of malpractice and premiums, because we're a state that's having a serious problem in terms of the availability and the cost of malpractice insurance. But otherwise, if you look at our payroll, if you look at our benefits, we're pretty much the same as most other states. One thing I'll point out, we employ over 55,000 people in Oregon, and hospitals provide a full health care benefit package to their employees. One of the things that we've experienced over the last 2 years, we saw a 27% increase in our benefits as opposed to roughly a 12% increase in actual payroll. That's over a two-year period. So if you're looking at the challenge and the problem of the increasing cost of health insurance, we suffer from it as much as any other industry in the state because we're very labor-intensive, and unfortunately, because our employees work around the health care delivery system, we also are probably high utilizers of the health care delivery system. So we certainly feel the pain of higher health insurance premiums. But if you look at what the drivers are that make things a little bit unusual, first of all, you've got to realize that neither the Medicare nor the Medicaid program pay the actual cost of providing care. I think part of the material that I provided to you shows, in fact, not only what those levels are as a percentage of cost, but also how they've actually fallen over the two-year period that I looked at. That's a comparison of 2002 with 2004. In 2004, Medicare paid us roughly 86.7% of the actual cost of providing care to Medicare beneficiaries. Medicaid paid roughly 73.5% of the actual cost of providing care to their beneficiaries. Now, that's part of the cost shift. The government programs don't pay what it actually costs. But the biggest driver that we're seeing is actually as a result of the huge increase that we've seen in the numbers of uninsured. And I think everyone has heard the numbers. We've seen over 200,000 people lose their health insurance over the last 4 or 5 years, or the 3 or 4 years since the recession hit. We're now above the national average from being kind of a standout and a national showcase with insurance rates that were almost down to 10% of uninsured. We're now up to 17%, and we've had the most rapidly growing number of uninsured in the country. At the same time, we've seen a shrinking in the size of the Medicaid program, which have thrown even more people into the ranks of the uninsured. If you look at the numbers that I provided you, you'll see that our charity care over a two-year period, and I'm now talking about the cost of charity care, I'm not talking about billed charges, I've reduced this to the actual cost. We saw a 134% increase in charity care from $59 million in 2002 to $139 million in 2004. Bad debts saw a 70% increase from $89 million in 2002 to almost $152 million in 2004. And if you combine those, what we saw was a 94% increase in the cost to us, the actual cost of uncompensated care to hospitals, rising from $148 million to $290 million. So if you're looking at what's really been pushing these costs up, it's the fact that government programs, number one, continue to erode slightly in what they pay, and they do pay less than the cost. At the same time that that's occurring, we've seen a 50% increase in the number of people that we have uninsured in the state, over 609,000 people without insurance. And if we're concerned about how they're getting care, for the most part they are getting care either through safety net clinics or they're getting them through hospital emergency rooms. And that's one of the reasons that we've seen almost a 100% increase in the cost of uncompensated care. And ultimately that gets passed on to everyone. If we could have a Maryland system where Medicaid and Medicare and all insurers shared in that burden, you'd see a significant reduction in the cost of care. But if you take a look at where we are today, we cannot have the Maryland system as much as we might like it because, quite frankly, it would cost this state roughly $140 million per biennium just to bring the Medicaid program up to cost. It would cost the Medicare program roughly $240 million a year to bring us up to cost, and that's not going to happen. And so, ultimately, that is the problem that we're dealing with. As a state, we spend less money on hospitals than just about any other state in the union, including Maryland. In terms of the payments to hospitals in Oregon, we are on a par with Maryland. And so I think that what we need to look at, among other things, is a way to deal with the uninsured. One of the things that you're going to hear later on when we get into it is that I think there is an effort that's going to make a lot of information available to the public. But I don't see this as doing anything and quite of value. And quite frankly, if you want to take a look at a worst-case scenario of putting in place a rate setting system where we really didn't know what we were doing and we were making it up as we were going along. And by the way, Medicare and Medicaid aren't going to play. Take a look at West Virginia. One of the things I have in the information is a quote made in January when the new commissioner of the Rate Setting Commission in West Virginia reported to the Senate Committee with Jurisdiction and talked about the fiscal crisis that hospitals in West Virginia were facing. And so that's the problem that they have, is that they're not sharing those costs. The costs are being piled up onto a small base, the same problem that we have here in Oregon. Be happy to answer any questions.
What percent, do you know what percent of the cost of the hospitals is due to uninsured?
If you...
Uninsured.
The answer is yes, and I hope that I have that with me. I know that issue has come up in terms of how you, in terms of how you measure it, and... What I have done.
50% is it?
It is my recollection, and I don't want to be sworn to tell the truth on this because I want to make sure I check my numbers. But it seemed to me that what I did was I expressed it as a percentage of expenses. I reduced both charity care and bad debts to an expense, and then expressed it as a percentage of expenses. And I believe the number for 2004 was I want to say 8.4%. So it's a significant number.
Okay, but when you look at...
I was wrong. Charity care expressed at its actual cost to Oregon hospitals in 2002 represented 1.4% of total expenses. Bad debts expressed in actual cost represented 3.4%. Combined uncompensated care represented 4.8% of total hospital expenses in 2002. In 2004... charity as a percentage of expense rose to 2.7% and bad debts rose to 5.7%. Combined uncompensated care as a percentage of total expenses rose to 8.4%.
Okay. So it may get up to 10%. And what you were saying is if we could take care of the uninsured, the bad debt, that would take care of the high cost of hospital care, and that seems to be less than 10% of the total cost. And so even though we are the average regarding cost expense, the net operating revenue per capita is, ours is actually less than Maryland's, et cetera. It's still too much for Oregonians.
Well,
and I would love Oregon to be cutting edge in the nation. What system will cut to the chase and start decreasing the high premiums that we have? I take a look at the hospitals that are expanding, having new birthing centers, and having every hospital has to have all of the imaging technology, etc. And those, I think, costs are at, if not more, driving the hospital cost rates up. And so why I was excited about 502, at least it was a start. No one is coming to the plate. And if hospitals could just come to the plate and say, hey, we've got to look at becoming more efficient. We've got to look at cutting costs. So that's what I'd like to see. This rate regulation is a start. And so I hear what you're saying when you say just take care of uninsured, but I think we need to take a look at how hospitals, what their expenses really are and how to maybe become more efficient in that line.
Madam Chair, I agree with you. First of all, I would say in a lot of ways, and the hospitals can't take all the credit for this, it's the way medicine is practiced in Oregon, but number one, we have the second shortest hospital length of stay in the country, and we have the shortest Medicare length of stay in the country. We have the fewest number of patient days per thousand population for Medicare. Shortest, smallest in the nation. We rank 45th in Medicare spending per beneficiary. So if you're looking at the cost of this system in Oregon, it is cutting edge and far better than many other states in the country. Hospitals are forced to survive, to continually look for ways of becoming more efficient, more cost effective. And keep in mind that, you know, that's part of the ongoing, I guess you could say, management. What you're talking about, is there a regulatory solution that is going to work? And I think one of the things you have to understand, if you take a look at, you know, we've talked about the growing administrative burden. I mean, think of all of the additional regulatory requirements, the Health Information Portability Act, all of the HIPAA requirements that have been put upon us. I mean, the confusion of billing with multiple different requests coming from different insurers in terms of the kinds of information they want. We get multiple players, each one having their own ideas about quality are going to be. And I think that the hospitals are, you know, we are taking an assertive role both in the area of trying to determine how we're going to work with others in defining quality and determining what kind of information is going to be made available so that people can have a better understanding. But I do disagree by thinking that if you put some kind of a regulatory process in place that has only worked in one state in this country, and that's Maryland, and they started over 30 years ago, and they got a pretty good deal from the federal government. I took a look. If we were paid on a per beneficiary basis as much as Maryland is, we would be raking in $490 million a year more in Medicare reimbursement than we currently are. I mean, they have a system where they have maximized federal participation in the cost of health care. And what that has done is to the people who actually have to pay for insurance, to the labor organizations who are concerned about negotiating contracts and what the health care package is going to be, they've got a partner. The partner is the state through the Medicaid program, and the partner is the federal government through the Medicare program, who say we're not only going to pay what it costs to provide care to our beneficiaries, we're also going to share in the burden of the uninsured. And so that's why the average person who's got to buy insurance is getting a heck of a deal there. If you look at just the cost, what does it cost to run our system versus what it costs to run their system, we're actually slightly better than them, even without the rate setting. But I agree, and I think there are a lot of efforts going on, particularly with the Office of Health Policy and Research, to look at what are the cost drivers, what are the ways of finding efficiencies, and what's the kind of information that needs to be reported. I think that pursuing those and continuing to move forward in that direction makes a lot more sense than passing a bill that, quite frankly, is going to do nothing but put another layer of bureaucracy, and it's not going to find a solution for what's really driving the cost of health care.
So if the real what's really driving the cost of health care, you're saying, is the low reimbursement rates?
That's one of the factors that is driving the cost of private insurance. There are other cost drivers. I mean, obviously, the cost of the supplies that we buy, the fact that to some degree you have freestanding non-hospital centers that take the paying patients and you know, reduce the way in which we can spread those costs over a larger patient base. I wouldn't say it's just the large. I'm saying that is a huge factor in driving those costs up. When you see a 100% increase in charity care, that's going to have an impact on what you need. I mean, that's an extra $100 million that we've got to find somewhere. But no, that's not the only driver. I said the other drivers are: we have a shortage of workforce, and so obviously it's an employee's market, and so that costs us. Benefits, because we provide health insurance, that's a cost driver as well. Utility, are we perfectly efficient? Of course not. But I don't think that putting an agency like this is suddenly going to find the solutions to which there are, you know, hundreds of people working on within hospitals trying to find ways in which they can deliver the care more cost effectively. Because, to, you know, there are motivations to do that because it's getting tougher and tougher to spread the cost of underpayment by government and non-payment by the uninsured. It's tougher and tougher to spread that to a smaller and smaller base. And we have the same fear. What's going to happen is we're going to keep piling on to the cost of people with insurance to the point where it's going to become unaffordable, and we're going to see more and more people uninsured, and at some point we're going to have a collapse where there's just absolutely no way that we can continue to do this cross-subsidization that we're doing right now. A rate-setting commission doesn't do anything because they're not bringing anybody else into the camp to help share in those costs. So, I mean, I have the same fear that all of you do, is that these we're going to price health insurance out of the reach of most businesses, and we're gonna be up in the, you know, in the levels of California with, you know, 20-25% of the population uninsured, and then it becomes and that affects everything. Cost of schools, cost of government, cost of running hospitals are all affected by that if we have fewer and fewer people to support the cost of providing care. If they would all pay their fair share, Medicare, Medicaid, and all employers, then we would have significantly lower health care premiums in Oregon. That's the big problem we have. I do want to say one other thing. We heard more and more about Oregon's per diem hospital costs being the highest in the nation. We have the second shortest length of stay. If you spread your costs over a significantly shorter period of time, you're going to, you know, you're concentrating it into a shorter period of time, and so you're going to have a higher cost. One of the things I looked at was the 10 highest cost states in terms of a per diem, and what I found was that 7 of those states, and I'd be happy to follow up with the specifics, 7 of those states were among the 10 states with the lowest length of stay. The other thing I looked at when looking at a per diem ranking of states is that Illinois, New York, Kansas, New Jersey, Michigan, Mississippi, Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, and I can go on and on and on, all have lower per diem expenses than does Maryland. The point I'm making here is that's a bogus statistic, looking for something to make us look bad. And in doing so, if they had taken a look where Maryland was, they'd see that it made Maryland look bad as well. The way you have to measure expenses is what are we spending as a state on a per capita basis?
Thank you very much, Mr. Rocha. I want you to stay there because we're now going to have our panel. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 502 at this point in time. 502 is going to be coming back, but I would now like to have the informational meeting. I want to open an informational meeting and a panel discussion on hospital rate regulation and transparency, and I've asked Mr. Rutledge, and if I could ask Mr. Colmer and Mr. Murray to come forward, and I don't, if you want to
sit together or I'll
and I know that Mr. Murray just said he had about 5 minutes of maybe summing up what maybe wasn't covered that might be pertinent for the committee to know before we have an exchange regarding.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just sort of as a closure in terms of the presentation that we did earlier, I wanted to just mention that in addition to having the ability to actually have an impact on the trend of hospital costs over time, which Maryland has had some great degree of success with, there are other features of rate setting that I think are very beneficial to the state. It gives the capability to, as I said before, it provides a high degree of financial stability for the hospitals, predictability. There is arguably lower administrative costs because they can focus on operating issues and not worry about having to negotiate 20-30 contracts with payers. year to year. They don't have to worry about what the state budget is doing generally or Medicare expenditures because of the all-payer aspect of rate setting. There are also other individual programs that we've been able to initiate that have significant value. I just wanted to mention those very briefly. One was the pay-for-performance initiative that we are starting up currently, which will get very directly at quality of care and providing financial incentives within the rate structure for hospitals to adopt quality processes and be measured on process indicators that are highly correlated with positive outcomes and high quality care. We are able to do that probably more effectively than the federal government, which is, you know, CMS has an initiative along those lines, because we are an all-payer system. We have the leverage through the rate-setting system covering all payers to do that. And so it's a very exciting time in Maryland because of that capability. Over time, too, we've been able to address issues such as nursing shortage by, on an annual basis, providing additional amounts in rates for hospitals to provide tuition assistance for nurses, to facilitate recruitment and retention activities on the part of hospitals, so that it has mollified those up and down trends in terms of the numbers of nurses that are available that we all experience some difficulty with during times of shortage. Another program that I'd call attention to you about is we have a program called the Bond Indemnification Program, whereby when there is a facility that has been closed in Maryland, we have the ability, in essence, to protect the bondholders from a default by providing in rates of all the hospitals payments to defease the existing public body obligations at that closed facility. It provides an additional level of insurance for those who invest in public facilities. And it also provides a degree of an incentive on the part of hospitals or hospital systems to close excess capacity. We've been quite successful in that regard, having closed six hospitals in the last 15 years through either directly through or connected to that bond program. So I guess the message to take away is it's not merely about cost control, access, equity, stability, and also financial disclosure and accountability. There are a myriad of other things that a rate structure, a rate setting system such as Maryland has, or even less than what Maryland has, would afford the state to pursue and achieve other goals.
Thank you. What I would like is maybe some comments regarding some of the issues that Mr. Rutledge had said regarding the comparisons between Oregon and Washington. I'm not sure. Would you be able to address some of those things?
I'd be happy to at least raise some of the points. I want to be clear in the material that we're going to be presenting at this point is that we're not here testifying on the merits of this particular bill,
right,
for or against, and certainly wish you well in making those difficult decisions. They're yours to make. It is difficult, obviously, in looking at two states that are a continent away from each other to figure out how you go about making fair comparisons. There are a couple of points that I would make based on what I heard earlier about the comparisons between the two. Indeed, it is the case that per capita costs, hospital costs, in Maryland are higher than they are in Oregon. I would submit, however, absent the rate setting system, we would be worse than where we are today. So even though we may be different and higher than Oregon, according to the numbers I heard, we're apart from each other by about 6% in per capita costs, not charges. Actually, in terms of charges, we're about the same. But in terms of per capita cost, we're about 6% different. If we did not have the rate setting program, I suspect we would have been a lot worse. Again, remember, on the per admission basis, we were 25% above the national average. We're now 6% below. On the charts that were distributed to you, on the length of stay, Maryland is below California on length of stay. For an East Coast state, That ain't bad, I would submit to you. And but where we were before rate setting was considerably higher than the national average and moving further away from it. So I don't think the issue here, again, is that you look just at a snapshot. Absent rate setting, Maryland, I think, would have been a lot worse. That's I think to do a more thorough comparison between on the per capita cost is probably a worthwhile thing to do. There are clearly and well documented differences between the East Coast and the West Coast in how medicine is practiced. Another important factor that most studies on healthcare costs would look at is that per capita income is a very strong and positive predictor of healthcare costs. Maryland has among the highest per capita income in the country, and that helps in some ways make Maryland more be able to afford more healthcare and hospital costs. It also tends to raise cost of operations and doing business when per capita income is higher. But I think that's a worthy pursuit. I think, as I said before, as bad as it was painted out to be, we would have been a lot worse if they had not been rate setting.
Now, another question that Mr. Rutledge raised was that it would cost us, anywhere between $140 to $200 million. And I thought that you said your system, you had hospital rates. So did they pay for themselves? I mean, do they? I'm not quite sure.
You're talking about the additional regulatory costs of running the system
the additional costs of Medicaid?
Probably both. I know that the reimbursement rate is much higher in Maryland than it is in Oregon. At least that's what I've heard, those on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
That's one
on
thing.
Medicare, yeah.
But I had thought that you had said something about you had charged a fee to the hospitals to run the program. Did I misunderstand?
The budget, yes, we're financed through user fees. It's about a $10 charge. It's less than that, actually. I'm sorry. It's about $7 charge per admission to finance the commission operation. That's how we're funded. So we're an independent agency. It's outside the general fund.
Okay.
But that's then creates our budget of $3.5 to $4 million per year, which basically is the administrative cost of the state for running the program.
So how much general fund?
There are no general funds. It's completely outside the general fund in Maryland.
So now try to explain to me, who doesn't really understand all of the Medicare and Medicaid issues, the difference between Oregon and Maryland. How does the system differ regarding our reimbursement rates?
For Medicare?
Medicare.
Well, Medicare pays hospitals outside of Maryland on the basis of a system known as the prospective payment system, which is based on historical costs at one point in the distant past that have been inflated forward, adjusted for labor market differences, and take into account what the federal government allows as inflation updates each and every year.
Oregon.
As was stated in the testimony before, and I don't know this, I have not independently calculated it, to know what portion of reasonable costs in Oregon the Medicare payment level is, but it was said that it's roughly, they pay roughly 90% of costs in Oregon. So what the hospitals say their costs are, they're getting only 90 cents on the dollar for Medicare. In Maryland, because of the rate setting system, Medicare actually pays slightly above what the hospital's costs are as a result of the rate setting system. Now, it still turns out to have been a bargain for Medicare, because absent the rate setting system, hospital costs in Maryland since the inception of PPS would have gone up 250%, and in fact they went up in Maryland about 200%. So it's, they may be paying more than costs, but they're paying less than what they would have if they had gone up at the rate of increase in payments per admission nationally. So it's been a good deal for Medicare in Maryland.
We have a number of businesses that are now dropping insurance. I mean, the people that are hurting in Oregon are really the businesses, small businesses, and the uninsured regarding charges, particularly. In Maryland, do you have, what is your uninsured rate? Do you know?
I was asked that during the break here. I can't recall right off the top of my head. I think it is around 13 or 14%.
And ours is?
17.
17, okay.
And it has been relatively stable over time. I mean, we have not had the spike that you have had that I've heard earlier that you had recently here.
And that's probably due to our unsustainable Oregon health plan.
Well, the recession. I mean, a lot of people lost their jobs and they lost their insurance. I figure that roughly maybe as much as 25 to 30% of the new uninsured are people who lost their health plan coverage, but the rest are just people who lost their coverage for losing jobs or else not being able to afford their premiums, those things, private sector.
But what we heard here was that there was an increase in the cost of uncompensated care, both charity care and bad debt. And we don't... In Maryland, we don't make the distinction between the two because one person's bad debt is another person's charity care. It's really sort of a difficult line to make. The fact is that they're, in total, money that the hospitals are not getting. But that increase was from 4.8%, right, to 8.4%. So that, by itself, accounts for, you know,
4.8%. What?
4.8% of costs.
Of costs.
In 2002, is that what you?
Yeah. 8.4%. So that's 3.6. You know, a little more, 3.5, not quite 4% increase over that period of time in uncompensated care. So while it's been a large increase, it's a lot of money that is involved. It certainly doesn't go. A way of explaining, you know, the entire rate increases or the cost increases that hospitals here in Oregon are having. It's a serious problem, but you have to put it into that perspective. It's not as if it went from 0 to 8.4%. It went from 4.8 to
8.4. Mr. Kobe.
Thank you, Chair. I was curious about the short hospital stay Oregon having... shorter hospital stays than other parts of the country.
Percentage point.
Right. What does that attribute to? Is it possibly, I mean, what role does perhaps managed care have in maybe a higher penetration rate here in Oregon versus other
pretty
parts?
High penetration rate in managed care in Maryland, in part because of the presence of the federal government in the Washington, D.C. area. They have encouraged managed care there. As well as, I suspect, in part, the rate-setting system. They're not incompatible. And by managed care, I don't simply mean PPOs. I mean closed-panel HMOs and point-of-service products are above the national level. I don't have the exact statistics here, but those are readily available.
But why the shortened hospital or the shorter hospital stays in Oregon versus, for example, Maryland?
There are differences. Again, if you look at the chart that Mr. Rutledge produced, it's not that great a difference. And indeed, Maryland, as an East Coast state, actually does pretty darn well in comparison to others. So there is a difference. Part of it I would ascribe, and I think most people who have looked at this, ascribe it to simply differences in practice patterns,
yes.
The way physicians are trained and the way in certain regions of the country, things are done. It's just, it has been that way. I think length of stay has fallen in Maryland more rapidly than it has in most other states, and I think that is partly driven by the incentives in the rate system. Your lower length of stay, you lower your costs and hospitals, your aggregate costs, as Mr. Rutledge pointed out. But in Maryland, the difference is the hospitals don't lose all of that revenue because of the rate setting system. They're able to get rewards under the per case revenue constraint that Bob talked about earlier, and they're able to use that additional money to go to the bottom line and finance capital requirements, pay better salaries, and so forth.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I apologize if you covered this because I was out of the room for a minute, but Ms. Kreider mentioned startup costs and going to our emergency board and so on, and Ken mentioned $200 million or $150 million and so on to even get somewhere close to where you guys are. Now, one other part of that question is, we can't replicate your system because, well, as far as waivers, what kind of waiver can we get that would not cost us $200 million to play catch-up?
Well, again, I think I had said earlier that I could conceive of a system in which Medicare, and Medicare I would start as the big payer to worry about because they represent 30% I suspect 40% of revenue here. It is unlikely that you're going to convince Medicare to pay more than what they are paying now in aggregate. In fact, under the waiver provisions that I talked about that are available, which is 1886C, is you have to demonstrate that indeed it is not going to be any greater in absolute payment in Oregon than what it would have been absent the system. What it involves then is redistribution, so that it may mean for some hospitals that are being, and hard as it may be for any hospital to admit it, that may be being overpaid by Medicare. If you do a fair comparison and look at what it ought to be, and pay more to hospitals who should be getting paid more than what Medicare does. It may well be that there are inequities in the way Medicare pays within Oregon that doesn't in aggregate cost the system anymore, but may redistribute the money more fairly among those hospitals. And again, I think, as I said earlier, I could conceive of a system in which a state would, in addition to those redistributional things, bring to the table to the federal government experimental programs to deal with things like payment for performance or other areas that Medicare is interested in, that you could say, hey, here is a demonstration. We want to be able to show Medicare ways in which we can operate our system more effectively. Would you be willing to make that trade-off that they might be willing to do that? I can conceive of it. I know that it is not a slam dunk in any sense, and I know that it, particularly if you're talking about redistribution, that's not an easy political thing to do for any trade association to say to some members, some are going to get more and some are going to get less.
Madam Chair, and let me do one clarification on the Medicaid, but in terms of the Medicare, so what we're hearing is we're not going to get any more in the aggregate, and one of the problems, maybe the positive things about Maryland is that it was at one time a high cost state, and they put the commission in. And as a result, they can continue to show that they are less expensive than they would otherwise be. I think that in the case of Oregon, this has always been on a comparable spending basis a relatively low-cost state. And you could say a lot of that had to do with the early influence of HMOs, particularly Kaiser Permanente here. So it's always been a relatively efficient in terms of utilization and in cost. When you look at redistributing Medicare, keep in mind that we are 45th in the nation in terms of what we receive per Medicare beneficiary. We're already down at the bottom of the heap. We receive more than $1,000 less per beneficiary than they receive in Maryland. As to the Medicaid, what I was talking about there is I did a simple calculation. If you if we were to merely bring our Medicaid payment levels up to the actual cost of providing care, no margin intended, but bring it up to cost, and then do the pro rata share of, I just looked at charity care, I didn't look at bad debt, that would cost roughly $140 million in general fund revenues, plus the federal matching fund, just to get our Medicaid program up to where it pays the cost, this concept of an all-payer. And so I made that point by saying Medicare won't pay us anymore, and Oregon can't afford to pay us anymore, so we will not have an all-payer system. We're talking about a rate-setting commission that focuses only on that roughly 41% of the business that is not government, uninsured, or state government.
Although, but I would suspect that it would still cover the uninsured if one of the issues that you've heard about is this question of inequity between what is charged to uninsured patients versus what is charged to the commercial patients.
Senator Morissette.
We don't have a work session scheduled, so they haven't done a fiscal impact statement. How would they do a fiscal impact statement on this bill? Would they take Ken's word for it, or would they?
I know. We don't have a real transparency system with
our
hospitals.
I'll give you my working papers.
So.
Well, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out I like the idea of what we're doing, and I'm trying to figure out how far we have to go to implement. And Ms. Kreider did, you know, talk about going to, you know, it's going to take them startup costs. And I'm wondering what the pluses and minuses are of the money that we're going to put in to start with and what we're going to get and when we're going to get it.
I'd also point out that at least in Maryland's experience, to help guide you, the law was passed in 1971. Rate setting didn't begin until 1974. So there was a long period of time to get startup. Here, I think in the bill, they're anticipating a year to get startup, and that might be reasonable. But we did not get a waiver in Maryland until 1977. So this was a system that was not all payer for 3 years. Now, it was something that the commission wanted to negotiate and approached the people at HHS. It wasn't even HICS at that point. It wasn't even HHS. It was HEW. Probably back then. I know I'm not supposed to use acronyms, but...
Showing his
age.
Just
showing my age is really more like it. There was a period of time when it was not an all-payer system, and it did operate and operate effectively.
But you had the hospitals on board,
mm-hmm.
and the board was, or commission or whatever you called it, was made up of how many hospital care providers?
The majority, it's like the law here, right. The law is drafted here. The majority are not connected with the management or operation of a hospital. Were there hospital people on the commission?
Yes, in fact, the first chair of the commission was Alvin Powers,
right.
The CEO of Bon Secours.
Right.
And so we've traditionally had 1 to 2 hospital administrators on the board itself. And then
and nurses.
And physicians that are practicing at Maryland hospitals.
Yes, Ben.
Okay. I remember your description of who ran the hospitals at the time. They were not the hospital administrators who were making decisions
at the hospital association,
But they were foundations.
They were the hospital trustees.
Trustees.
Yeah. It was the board of directors of the Maryland hospitals. Made up the board of directors of the Maryland Hospital
Association. And what did you say about their motivation?
What I said was, and I believe this to be true today, is that hospital trustees have a broader perspective on the issues of hospital costs than, in all due respect, than do hospital administrators. They are also, in addition to their roles as hospital trustees, people who also have to pay the bills. They are community leaders, business owners, political leaders in some cases where they have to pay the cost. So they have a slightly different perspective on the value of containing hospital costs.
May I ask a
follow-up?
Mr. Rutledge, how is Oregon set up in terms of hospital trustee?
Well, we're, Maryland is indeed unique, and in fact, it's interesting because the current head of the American Hospital Association was the longtime CEO of the Maryland Association, and he takes credit for actually having drafted or having had his staff draft the original rate-setting bill in Maryland. Our hospitals are operated the same way in which hospitals in Maryland and across the country, with boards of trustees that are made up of, you know, depending on what the, whether it's a local governmental unit, but basically local business people, local citizens who serve on that board in a, as, you know, and have the, basically have the responsibility for overseeing the decisions are made. The major difference is that my association, the people I work for, my board is made up of primarily hospital CEOs, as opposed to Maryland, where my counterpart has a board that is made up primarily of hospital trustees. But in terms of how the hospitals operate, the same kind of governance variations as you would find here.
Okay. I guess what I was getting at is that very point. The hospital trustees are the decision makers of where the hospitals go rather than the hospital administrators. Is that the difference?
For the trade association.
For the trade association,
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, correct. So the hospital trustees tend to be more community-oriented and see the bigger picture, where the hospital administrators are more bottom-line oriented and so on. And I think that may be a difference in our two systems. And
it was also, I mean, if you think about this, we're talking about this originated in 1971. This is only, what, 3 or 4 years after the passage of Medicare?
And Medicare passed in 65.
Okay, so we're talking about 6 years after the passage of Medicare. And even if you looked at Medicaid and Medicare and private sector payments, there weren't huge variations. It was a very bold, bold thing to do. And it's the only one of the, as I said, we had rate setting in a lot of other states, including Washington. And the one place where it has worked, and I don't think there's any doubt about it, and there are a whole lot of reasons that it's worked, but the one place that it has worked and has worked very successfully is in Maryland. In other states, it was determined in 7 of those states that it was not working for whatever reason, and so they abandoned it. And we have one other state, West Virginia, that retains it. And I can't see anything in the profile of West Virginia that would indicate that it has done anything to bring costs down in that state.
Well, clearly it's the quality of the executive directors and rate-setting systems in Maryland that have done it entirely, and I would encourage you, if you consider it here, to think about that. No, and all kidding aside, I do think that there is a thing to be said about the quality of the staff that has worked in Maryland. As I said earlier, I think there are the nature of the relationships that existed between the hospital industry and the payers and the rate-setting system that meet. Let it continue. I think there are fundamental differences in the way each of those states regulated the hospital, whether they were all payer or not. Bob talked about the difference between a per-case payment system, which is what they had in New Jersey and New York and Massachusetts, and a system in Maryland that has departmental unit rates and a per-case revenue constraint, that align the incentives between the hospitals and the payers. There are subtle differences that led it to be more successful. And so, while I joke that it was the quality of the executive directors, there were I think there are good reasons to explain why it existed. Finally, in the case of New Jersey, New York, and Massachusetts, when PPS came in, those hospitals in those states thought that they were going to do better under Medicare PPS, and they lobbied hard in their legislature to get the systems repealed. In the case of New Jersey, there was a court case that was going on that was brought against the rate system and went to the Supreme Court there, the so-called Travelers case, that threatened the all-payer system. The notion that you would have ERISA plans, these are the self-funded insurance plans that are not subject to state insurance regulation, that they would not be subject to hospital rate setting. And the people in New Jersey, in addition to worrying about PPS and getting more money, they were afraid they were going to lose that case. The case was going to take out of rate setting the ability to set rates for half of or more of the commercial payers in the state. Well, as it turns out, they won the case. But by that point, they had given up the rate setting, the all-payer rate setting system. And it was too late for them in New Jersey.
It's a crapshoot.
One other question. Is there anything that we can learn from West Virginia?
Oh, I'm sure there is, and I'm sure there's lots of things.
Let me rephrase the question. Are they a basket case, or are they on their way to doing something really good, and we should take a look at their experiences and learn from them and figure out?
Clearly, experiences are different. We are neighbors. We do share a common border with West Virginia. I think it would probably be worthwhile for you to find out from, as you have from us, from the regulators there about it, to hear maybe from the regulatees there is as well. I don't know enough, frankly, about how it operates, mm-hmm. other than in just very general terms, to advise you what you might learn from it. But I would suggest that it is probably worth your while to find out more, and I'd be happy to put you in touch with the people that I know in West Virginia who run the system, and I'm sure that Ken will be happy to put you in touch with folks at the West Virginia Hospital Association, which, by the way, is run by somebody who came from Maryland as well.
I used to run it.
and Ken used to run it. They'd be happy to tell you what their experience is like. And so, yeah, I would say it's worth your while finding out.
Madam Chair, I wanted to make just one very quick comment. It is based on some comments that were made earlier. Maryland did, I think, benefit from the fact of being high back in the 70s, and there were some opportunities to cut costs. So along with all the other things that we've mentioned, it made the system successful, the cooperation, the common vision, the shared goals. But we have succeeded. We've gotten to a point where we're relatively low, very low by East Coast standards, low by national standards, comparable to some of the West Coast states as well. The fact that we're low does not mean now that we are ready to abandon rate setting. And I would submit to you, I think it's all about the trend and the future and the fact that in the healthcare marketplace you do have these market failures and these distortions and these inequities such that for low states there's far more potential to grow and grow rapidly in the future. And if you don't have a mechanism to protect against that, you're basically taking a big risk. I'm very happy that Maryland still has a system. Because we're low, we wouldn't abandon it. And by the fact that you are low is not a reason necessarily not to do it.
I would like to just sort of sum up, unless anyone else has some. I would really like to have a lot more transparency in the Oregon system with the hospitals, because we have wide variation in what one hospital charges versus another hospital. And I know with rate regulation you obviously don't have that, and we don't. I haven't even really looked at what the goals of our hospitals here are. I would think that their mission would be sort of community oriented, but I don't. And we don't even have access to who the names of the trustees are in the hospitals. And there's a lot of, I would say, transparency issues that rate regulation would require. But I would really hope that the hospitals would come forward with plans to really look at the cost, the charges. Not necessarily the cost, but the charges, because it does vary significantly between those who are uninsured and the private payers. So,
as you know, Madam Chair, we've had a brief conversation about this, and the very kind of information that you're talking about, we are hoping will be up on a website accessible to the public that will allow them to look at each and every hospital in the state, including their charges for each kind of procedure they perform. So I'm working with the state on that, but you know, we have that kind of data here in Oregon. It's just a matter of getting it organized and getting it where people can see it.
I'm from Springfield, and we have a community hospital that is dead. It was purchased by a Texas company, Triad, the third largest, and we have two giants now competing against each other, Peace Health, which is predatory. We have a lot of predatory hospitals now. I think when we were talking certificate of need in our area, which we still need, we still have to have it, the public health, Grant Higginson was the hearings officer, and he said we urged them not to have a certificate of need in our metro area, and because they don't have it in the Portland metro area. And he said, well, that's not true. We're going back to a certificate of need because some of the giants in the Portland area are starting to infringe on each other's territory, and so they're going back to certificate of needs. And I think that's the thing that disturbs me, is we will end up in Springfield, Eugene, and Lane County with one hospital. There will be one when this whole thing is done. These two giants can't, they can't, either the costs are going to be so high or one of them is going to sell out to the other, and I know who's going to go back to Texas, so I don't think it's going to be Peace Health. I see this happening in the hospitals, and there are a lot of small hospitals that are not making it, barely making it. Some of them are doing fine, but the big ones are consolidating, and they're predators. And they will take over the state. They will put up their little branches here and their little branches there, and that'll be the end of that, and then the prices will go out of sight. That's my personal opinion, and I'm watching it happen. Our little hospital, McKinsey Willamette, was founded 50 years ago by the sweat of the community, and it's gone. They won a restraint of trade suit against Peace Health. $17 million, because Peace Health had a sweetheart deal with the insurance company that helped to sink McKinsey Willamette, and they went to court, and McKinsey Willamette won for all the good it's doing them.
Right.
But they're gone. I don't have a local.
Do you want to comment?
The only thing I want, I don't want to talk about McKinsey Willamette and Sacred Heart.
No, it's Peace Health, not Sacred Heart. They're
Peace
dead.
Health. If you look at almost all of the consolidation that has gone on over the last 10 years, it has been organizations like Samaritan Health System or Providence or St. Charles who have rescued small rural hospitals who otherwise would not have made it, given them the protection in terms of cost, being able to buy things more cost effectively, and giving them more clout in negotiating with insurers to get better payments. So I think that before we talk about this consolidation, we've got to remember that there are a whole lot of rural hospitals out there who are operating in the red and who were looking for someone to partner with, and in many instances, that's exactly what happened. And I think that's the consolidation that we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years, not the other way.
Well, there are a lot of hospitals working in the black, and I am most concerned about Oregonians who aren't getting health insurance, as far as I'm concerned, if the costs keep rising, it's either going to implode or explode, whatever way you want to look at it. And I would hope that the hospitals wouldn't poo-poo the rate regulation bill, but really start coming to the table and making some constructive give us some constructive ways or ideas that we can address the high costs of health care, because we can't just blame it on fixing the uninsured. I think there's a lot of other things. For instance, what Senator Morissette was saying regarding the certificate of need and the ambulatory surgical centers that are cropping up, and there's just a lot of things that are happening, and I want a system that's going to help Oregon, and I think the committee feels that way. Anyway, I want to thank Mr. Comer and Mr. Murray for flying out here from Maryland. It's snowing back in Maryland, so they're hoping that they can get back. Have you heard the latest weather report?
Wow.
Anyway, thank you so much, and thank you, Mr. Rutledge, for being a part of this discussion and for the public that's here, too. Any other words? of wisdom. Okay, medium adjourned.
You guys have a good